This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest has been threatened with death because of the work she does. Dr. Susan Wicklund performs abortions, and she works in regions where few, if any, doctors are willing to do it. Dr. Wicklund is now the medical director of a clinic in Bozeman, Montana, but for several years she was commuting back and forth between clinics in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and North Dakota in communities that otherwise would have had little or no access to abortion. Her refusal to be intimidated has won her many honors. The latest will be presented next week by the Elizabeth Blackwell Healthcare Center for Women in Philadelphia. Earlier this month, several abortion rights groups sent letters to Attorney General Janet Reno demanding that attacks on abortion clinics or doctors be classified as a form of domestic terrorism. I asked Dr. Wicklund if she felt she was adequately protected by local law enforcement.
Yes and no. There's been a couple of instances where some of the law enforcement officers just didn't know what to do. I'm thinking of an incident in my home where there was a number of protesters at night, and the local law enforcement agency just did not have enough officers to be able to deal with them. They had said they would wait and deal with it in the morning. In the meantime, that meant that we had people on our property and surrounding our home all night long with no protection. We had to wait till daylight. It felt pretty strange to not be protected at night, but it would be protected in the daytime.
This because there weren't enough officers on the night shift?
There weren't enough officers in the entire county. This is a rural county in northern Minnesota.
So what did you do all night?
We stayed inside the house with the doors locked and the lights off and waited till morning.
And what was the protest like that was going on outside your house?
Well, there was actually protesters outside of our house many nights for a little better than a month in the fall of 1991, and that's the time period that I'm talking about. So different nights were different scenarios. Sometimes it'd be three or four people, sometimes 50 or 60 people outside of the house. Some nights would sneak out and get to a vehicle and so I could get to work the next morning. Some nights we stayed all night if I didn't have to go to work the next day. There was a long time when my daughter was taken to and from school in a police car because the protesters would let the police car enter and leave our property when it had her, when they were transporting her back and forth.
I know at one point you had hired bodyguards. Do you still have personal bodyguards?
I have one clinic that I always have a personal bodyguard with me whenever I go in and out of the building. That's a clinic in Bozeman, Montana. I work at a clinic in Fargo, North Dakota, and they also have hired security at that clinic whenever there's clinic days.
Do you feel protected when you have bodyguards, or do you still feel vulnerable?
Unfortunately, I feel that if there's somebody out there crazy enough to risk their life or to sacrifice themselves to hurt me or any other person, that they'll probably be successful in doing that regardless of what precautions I take. The precautions I do take, I hope, will deter the person who's not quite over the edge that much and will respect a guard dog or a weapon or someone walking beside me.
Your bodyguards are armed?
Sometimes and sometimes not.
I know some doctors who provide abortions have taken to wearing bulletproof vests to protect themselves. Is that a precaution you take?
I frequently wear a bulletproof vest, yes.
What are some of the ways you've been harassed? You mentioned the demonstrations outside of your home.
We've had stuff going on for a number of years, everything from people in airports screaming at us, screaming at other passengers to not get on with that baby killer, letters, phone calls in the night, vandalism to the home or vehicles, people stalking or following me to and from work to my home, etc., harassing my daughter, flyers around the town. Recently there was a wanted poster that was put up at a hotel in Bozeman, Montana with my face on it saying that I was wanted for the murder of young boys and girls and reward. That caused quite a stir in the town. Thankfully, the townspeople were very intolerant of this man's behavior and have put a stop to that poster immediately.
It sounds like usually when you're followed, it's to and from work. Do you have people following you when you're just going to the grocery, when you're just
happened.
Your personal life?
Yeah, it's happened many times in the past. It hasn't been as frequent recently, and I believe it's because of this anti-stalking law that has been passed in a number of states. And in fact, all the states that I'm currently working do have anti-stalking laws, and it seems to have made a huge impact in how much harassment I'm getting on a personal basis coming to and from work.
Have you had to become an expert in how to identify somebody?
Oh, absolutely. I'm always aware of who's around me, which cars have been following me for a number of blocks, which people I've seen in an airport more than one time. Quite good at recognizing faces from various cities when they come to other areas that I'm at, picking out those people who I feel are watching me for whatever reason.
Some doctors gave up providing abortions after Dr. David Gunn was murdered in Florida. What was your reaction after the murder? Did you feel more afraid? Did it put doubts in your mind about continuing with your work?
I definitely was more afraid. I was traveling with my father to go to a concert in Iowa, and I stopped at a gas station and had called back to my office just to see how things were going, and was told there was some bad news and that Jane Bovard in Fargo wanted to give it to me herself. So I called Jane, and she told me that Dr. Gunn had been murdered. And I remember sitting down on the floor below the phone in the gas station in a little town in northern Iowa, just crying and crying. And my father came in and said, what was wrong? And I told him that one of the abortion doctors had been murdered. And he just held me, and it was like, I wondered what's going on? How can this possibly be happening? It was, of course there was doubts. I want to live, but I also have real strong convictions, and it meant then that I had to take even more precautions and more safety and spend more money trying to make sure that I was protected as much as possible, but yet realizing that no one can be protected all the time and that we're always vulnerable in some area. But no, I am not going to quit my work.
For about 3.5 years, you worked in, several states. You were living in Minnesota, but you worked in Appleton, Wisconsin, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Duluth, Minnesota, St. Paul, Minnesota, and Fargo, North Dakota. In all of those places, they couldn't find doctors to provide abortions, and you had to fly in?
That's correct. The clinic in Milwaukee was one of three clinics in that area, possibly four at that time, and there was just a handful of doctors keeping those clinics open, and all the clinics were quite busy. I'm no longer working there, and they are having a hard time getting enough clinic days, from what I understand, but at least there's other clinics in the area patients can go to. In Appleton, there are no other clinics in that area, and I was the only physician traveling to that clinic at that time.
So what was your schedule like, traveling to all these different states?
Absolutely crazy. I was on the road most every day of the week. Sometimes I would have six clinics in 6 days. Sometimes I'd have seven clinics in 6 days, working a day clinic one place and a night clinic someplace else, just to keep the services going. I spent many, many nights in motels, lots of nights for a while, driving from one place to the other. This was during the height of the protesters, so that I could avoid airports for a while. The clinic in Duluth has a couple of different physicians that we would rotate, and they are also now a little shorter, but they are keeping their days going. The clinic in Fargo is the most critical as far as I'm concerned. It's the only clinic in North Dakota. There's two of us that are currently working there and have been for the last 5 years. We alternate weeks. If either one of us stops working, it'll put a real hard burden on the other person, probably a burden that wouldn't be able to be carried completely. So we are real determined to keep that clinic going with both of us working.
Why did you decide to stop going to some of the clinics that you'd been working at and to instead start working at the clinic in Bozeman?
There was a number of reasons. Some of them have to do with a preference on where I would like to eventually be living, and that's in the mountains in Montana. The Bozeman Clinic became available almost a year ago now, when the physician that had been running it for 12 years wanted to retire at the age of 72, and I decided to take over the clinic. It was real important to me that, after having spent 4 years of traveling around to a variety of clinics, being like a subcontractor, I guess you could say, for other clinics, that I finally get into a place where I felt I could make some of the major decisions on patient care, on counseling, on post-op care, on things that to me were real crucial and that I wanted to be able to have more control with.
So what were some of the changes you made in the Bozeman Clinic, changes that were congruent with what you thought should be done in clinics?
Mm-hmm. To me, the most crucial part for any woman faced with that decision is the emotional part of it. Has she gone through all of her options? Does she have good support? Is this really what she wants to do, or is it somebody else that's trying to coerce or push her into having an abortion? I do not do abortions for husbands or boyfriends or mothers. I do them only when the woman decides in her heart this is the best decision for her. And we sometimes have patients that we spend, 2 hours talking with before they get anywhere close to the procedure room and completely explain everything. I want them to know exactly what's going on, to have complete informed consent to all parts of the procedure. And there are sometimes we get, after spending an hour with a patient, that it's obvious that this really is not the decision that they want. And whether they're able to vocalize it or not, we sometimes send people home and say, I know your voice is saying yes, but your heart and your body language is saying no, and you need to go home and think about it more. Perhaps you'll come back, perhaps you won't. I have women get angry at me sometimes saying that it's their choice and I have to do the abortion, and I'll say, I don't have to do the abortion. That's my choice too. And generally, if those women come back, they're very grateful that they've been sent away and that they have had the extra time. The far majority of women, when they walk into the clinic, have thought about it. They know where they're at with it. They're real comfortable with it. They need some more counseling just to understand the procedure. They do not need to wait another 24 hours, 48 hours, 1 week, whatever. But the few people that do, I think, is crucial that they get that extra time and that we insist on it.
How can you tell, how do you evaluate if a woman is there to have an abortion because of her boyfriend or her parent, not because she really wants it?
After 5 years of doing this, there are so many signals that I have become attuned to with the women. Usually it's body language,
like
not making good eye contact, mm-hmm. Moving in different ways when you're about to do an exam. Sometimes it'll be some of the words they use when you're talking about abortion in general. There's many, many signals, and some of them more subtle than others. Generally, if I can, and I always do, get alone with the patient and just look them in the eye and really, really start talking to their heart and to their head, and not just to the intellect and not just to the words that they've heard come out of their mother's mouths or their boyfriend's mouths. You can generally get the women to really speak from their heart and tell what's going on with them.
My guest is Dr. Susan Wicklund. She runs an abortion clinic in Bozeman, Montana. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Susan Wicklund. She performs abortions in spite of the many threats against her. Would you say that anti-abortion protesters have been changing their tactics recently? Have you seen any change in the past few months?
We've actually noticed an interesting change in a number of places. It appears to me, from having watched this for the last 5 years, that some of the people that I would call normal protesters, this is people that is that are truly out there to exercise their freedom of speech, who are carrying signs that are not terribly offensive, but at least speaking their mind, but people that are not going to be the violent people. They seem to be less in numbers in front of the clinics now. And my interpretation of this is that they are afraid now of being lumped together with the absolute crazies out there, the ones who will firebomb the clinics, who will slash tires, who will shoot at doctors. And instead of being associated with the violent people, they've chosen to not be in front of the clinics at all. That's what I see. So I think the tactics have changed to be more violent. The few people that are still actively protesting are much scarier to me. I'm real worried about what's going to be happening in the next year. I feel like they've lost on many political grounds, and their only hope, as far as they see it, is to do the real drastic things that we've seen a sharp increase in the last 6-8 months.
What keeps you doing this, in spite of the threats against you?
I grew up in a real strong Scandinavian family in northern Wisconsin, and I just have always been taught and have always believed that you do what you believe in. And I feel that the kinds of response I get from my patients, the kinds of things that I see on a daily basis, and the support that I get from my family have all kept me going and will continue to keep me going. The bottom line is the patients, though. On a daily basis, when the people that I see, the people that I take care of, the stories I hear, the situations they're in, the things they dream about and hope about for their futures, all of that is what keeps me working with them. I think that abortion has to be safe and legal. I've had a horrible experience myself many, many years ago with an abortion where people did not explain to me what was going on. They didn't talk about what to expect before, during, and after the abortion, and I was terrified, and it was a horrible experience. It was still the right choice. I'm glad I went through with it. I'm glad I ended that pregnancy, but it should not have been done in such a traumatic way, and I am very determined to make sure that as many women as possible who choose to go that route, who choose to end their pregnancy, go through it in a compassionate, supportive, healthy environment, and I'm trying my hardest to provide that environment for people.
Did that experience have anything to do with your deciding to become a doctor or to perform abortions?
It had nothing to do with my decision to become a doctor, and it has effects now in that there isn't a single day that I don't think of that experience and continue to be determined not to let that happen to any of my patients.
What kind of harassment has your daughter been subjected to as a result of your work?
Well, riding in and out of the driveway in a police car is, with people videotaping you and screaming at you, is one place to start. The school that she goes to has been wonderful. There had been a number of protesters that came and distributed flyers on cars parked in the parking lot and then to students out in a gym class that said that I was a member of the community and my daughter went to school there and that I killed babies and that I should be stopped. And it was a gruesome, awful piece of paper that had lots of untrue statements and ugly pictures on it. That was distributed at my daughter's school a number of different times and in the building. They also came into the building looking either for her or a picture of her in the library. We're still not sure what their ultimate motive was. And spent some time in the school. They were removed from the school, and since then the school has put in a different security system, so to speak, so that my daughter is much better protected while she's at the school building.
How has she handled it?
Well, there was one day when I was in Fargo working and got a phone call from one of the school officials and said she was in his office hysterical and that she had clenched in her fist a poster with my picture on it and allegations of murder. And she was obviously hysterical about the fact that someone was calling her mother a murderer and was distributing these flyers in her school. And that was the hardest day of all. That was kind of the turning point right there. We've talked and talked and talked about all of this, and she understands what's going on. It hurts her when people call me awful things. But she's a strong kid, and she's survived well. She's had good support from some of her friends and her friends' parents and school people and all of our family. And now she's a real strong 16-year-old who believes very strongly in certain things that she'll fight for all of her life. She's doing fine.
When you said this was a turning point, what happened afterwards?
Well, we sat down and talked about this was probably going to be as bad as it was going to get, and could she handle it? She had always been afraid, what if they come to my school? What if they come to my school? And that was the day they did come to her school. That was also the day that I agreed to do the 60-minute segment, because it was at that point that I said I'd had it. I'd absolutely had it, and people had to know what was going on. It was just too bizarre to even believe this was the United States. It was the turning point in that the worst that she could imagine had happened, and she'd lived through it, and she knew she'd survived. And by the next day, she was three notches stronger, and I was no longer near as afraid of her begging me to stop working. She never has.
Had she begged you before to stop?
No, she has never begged me to stop working. I was afraid that she would. I was afraid that that would be the time that, if any time, that she would. But she did not and has not.
Would that have been a terribly hard choice for you if your daughter had begged you to stop working?
If my daughter had begged me to stop working, I would have stopped working.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only thing that would have stopped me.
Part of what the people who demonstrate against abortion want to do is change your mind, make you think that you are committing murder and that you have no right to do that and you should stop. Has anything that protesters have said done anything to shift your position or to get you to think in a slightly different way than you thought before?
Yes, actually. There have been a number of very interesting things that have happened to me that have made me look at the issue in different ways. Certainly not where I would stop working, or where, and I certainly do not feel I'm committing murder, obviously. But there's been two people in the recent past that I've had very good conversations with. One of them, interestingly enough, was a lawyer who was taking my deposition in Fargo and was working with the anti-abortion people up there, defending them. And while we were doing the deposition, we got into a conversation about life and bonding between people. And it made me think about a lot of things I hadn't thought about before. Again, certainly nothing that would make me stop working. But there was parts of the things that he said that made me understand a little better why the protesters do what they do.
And that's something, you want to understand.
Exactly. I do want to understand. And it's always encouraging to me when I get someone who is adamantly anti-abortion, who will sit down and talk from the heart and listen to what I say, and I'll listen to what they say. Unfortunately, 99.9% of my encounters with the protesters are people screaming at me as I go to and from the clinic, and they are not reasonable people, and they do not behave in reasonable ways, and they do not carry on reasonable conversations. But there's been two people, as I mentioned, in the recent past that I've had very good conversations with, and I'm willing to learn all the time, but I'll do it only with reasonable people.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Susan Wicklund directs the Montana Country Women's Clinic in Bozeman, Montana. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.